One of the things they didn't teach me in the seminary was how to put one of these on before everybody else. By now, Arthur Miller's play, The Death of a Salesman, has become something of a legend. It is an authentic tragedy of classic proportions. And what makes it so pungent to us is that it uses the very images that are most familiar to us in contemporary America. As most of you know, the main character in this drama is Willie Loman. And Willie Loman represents a man who has bought the American dream in its entirety. He had been taught from his earliest days that to live was to compete, and that if he would be aggressive, if he would work hard, if he would go out there and make the right contacts, that then he could achieve the highest of all goals, namely to come out the number one man. And so Willie Loman bought this dream with all of the intensity of his being, but the dream betrayed him. After 40 years of trying his best to compete and to come out ahead, he wound up an utter failure. Because of his competitiveness, he was not able to establish relations with anyone, with himself, with his wife, with his sons, or with the universe. And when the dream came crashing down on his head, he couldn't take it, so he got in his old car, deliberately drove into a tree, and took his own life. The play ends with a kind of requiem, where his two sons, Biff and Happy, are debating the issue of this life and death. Biff still hasn't gotten the point. He stands there over his father's grave and dares to say he had the right dream, the only dream a man can have, the dream of coming out a number one man. I'm going to see to it that he didn't die in vain. I'm going to go out there and beat that racket. But the other son, Happy, says, no, you're wrong. He had the wrong dream. In fact, this was the problem. He had the wrong dream, and therefore he never knew who he was. I'd like to suggest this morning that this issue that is being debated over Willie Loman's grave is really a most momentous issue for those of us who are gathered here this morning. For any kind of appraisal of the minister as a man is going to have to come to terms with this dream of Willie Loman. This dream of coming out the number one man. Because as I see it, the dream of Willie is the cultural matrix in which all of us have been born. Every one of us grew up in a country where ingrained in us was the ideal that competitiveness is the way to live, that coming out number one is the sunum bonum of life. And therefore, if we're going to be ministers, if we are really going to find the truth about ourselves, we're going to have to come to terms whether this dream is really the way you do your life and the way you do your ministry. And when I suggest to you that the American dream, the dream of coming out number one, is the issue we have to struggle with, I'm really not being abstract. I'm being very personal and very existential. For it's been struggles at this point that have characterized the most intense agony of my own existence. The earliest memories I have of myself as a little child were memories of feeling negative about my own being. I remember having a stifling sense of nobodiness, a feeling that I had no worth as I was. I remember my mother used to say to me, if you're ever going to amount to anything, you're going to have to make something of yourself. The emotional message that came through to me was, you're a big fat nothing as you are, a zero, an emptiness that desperately needs to be filled. Well, how does a nobody become a somebody? In America, he does it by out-competing, by pitting himself against other people and trying to come out ahead. And so long before I ever reflected on it consciously, I took a competitive stance toward life. I began to think that if I was going to have some worth, I had to earn it by being better than other people. And I can remember particularly the day I started high school, walking down the halls of that strange place and having this great feeling that I didn't matter. And I remember thinking to myself, unless I can become a star athlete, unless I can become an academic achiever, unless I can be a class officer, I don't really have a right to exist. My whole existence was bound up in trying to earn my right to be by outachieving. And this competitive stance characterized the whole of my existence. It characterized my life on through college, on through seminary, and on into the active ministry. I'm really hard put to explain to you this morning why the series of religious experiences that were mine never affected me down where I felt about myself. I accepted Christ when I was 9 years old under the influence of a charismatic evangelist. I was very active in the institutional church as a teenager. In late adolescence, I had an acute experience of intellectual doubt when I could not be sure of the shape of ultimate reality. But then in college, I think God really happened to me intellectually. I had a moving encounter when I came to believe that to the mystery of godness, the man Jesus gave a face. I really found in him a clue to ultimate reality. I really came to believe that Jesus was the essence of God. And on the basis of this intellectual experience and some other forces, I felt myself called to the ministry, and I gave myself to it with abandon. And yet none of these experiences penetrated down where I felt about myself. I still thought I was a nothing. I still felt I had to earn my right to exist by the things that I did, which means that seminary was essentially a competitive experience. I can remember the terrific pressure that I felt to come out number one in grades. I can remember the rotting effect on relationships that this kind of competitiveness produced. When you're always having to struggle against someone, you can't really be a brother and a colleague. And while there was a facade of companionship at the seminary, most of us knew deep down that we were engaged in the deadly battle of King of the Mountain, that we were struggling against each other for the few places of preeminence. We were living life as if you had to come out number one. And this experience went on into the active ministry. In fact, I can remember my first pastor that I went to my first state convention, and I came back feeling all dirty inside because most of the conversation out around that convention consisted of envy and criticism of those who were succeeding and feeding like vultures on those who were failing. About this time, it came to me that certainly there was a better way to do life. Certainly there was more to Christian community than this incessant achieving, this incessant competition. But I really did not know what to do. Here I was in my early 30s, still feeling worthless, still trying to compete. And then in the providence of God, two things happened at a period of distance of some months that were destined to change radically the way I feel about myself and my humanity. The first of these experiences happened in an unlikely place. It happened in a Kiwanis club in a downtown hotel in Louisville. The minister was much like Amos in that he was neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet. He happened to be a personnel manager for a large industrial firm there in the city. As he spoke that day to this Kiwanis club, he made the interesting distinction that whenever a young man joined his firm for training, the first thing he tried to find out was whether this man wanted to be something or to do something. Then he elaborated on this distinction. He said the man that wants to be something is the man who has unhealthy ego needs. He's a man who has to use every situation to enhance his reputation. Therefore, he moves to every decision with a double agenda. First, he's asking on the surface what needs to be done, but at a deeper level, he's asking, what can I do to come out on top? Now, he said the man that wants to do something is the man who has met his ego needs healthily. He has himself off his hands. He is free to ask in the problem situation what needs to be done task-wise. And the man said that the fellow who wants to do something is worth at least $500,000 more to the company in his career than the man who is hung up in having to be something. When I heard that personnel manager give this simple distinction, it was just like I'd had a mirror held up before me and I saw my own personality structure as never before. Here was a word of God sharper than any two-edged sword that cut right to the center of my being, and I had to confess I was the kind of man who was wanting to be something. In fact, I remembered back to all of those times I had done things in the ministry. And on the surface, I asked, did I do the right task agenda-wise? But deep down, I was asking, I wonder what they think of me. If I had spoken, I would sit down and think, I wonder if they liked me. How is this building block going to fit into my career pattern? I was desperately trying to be something because deep down I felt that I was a nothing. Now, this is a terrifying experience to have the truth about your being paraded before you inescapably, but this is what happened to me there in a Kiwanis club. The judgment of God became real and existential. Here was who I was. But frankly, I didn't know what to do with it. Here was this awful truth about the way I was organizing my life, but where do you go for help? Well, I had to live with this struggle for some months, and then came the second event in the providence of God that was going to be so life restorative to me. It occurred when a group of ministers decided to form a deep fellowship to meet once a week where we could try to get close enough and trusting enough to take off our protective mask and to really be who we are. This was the blessed fellowship where two or three gathered together in the name of Jesus, where love and acceptance and understanding began to build up. And finally, I got courage enough to take off my mask and to reveal to some brothers this thing I'd learned about myself. I was the kind of man who was deep down trying to earn his right to exist. And these brothers did not hear this with a sense of condemnation or despair, but they heard me with great tenderness as if they understood. And then I remember one of them said, "I know what you mean, Claypool. What you need to do is to read the New Testament with your guts." Like, for example, there in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, "You are the light of the world." He doesn't say you have to become the light of the world. You have to achieve in order to be the light of the world. You have to be better than other people if you're going to earn the light of the world. No, he says, you are the light of the world. This is what you are by the gift of creation. This is what God has made you to be. You already are somebody by virtue of what God has made you to be. You don't have to earn this right to exist by achieving. Therefore, let your light shine. Let the gifts that God has given you move out in love to those who need them, that men may see the good work that God has made in making you and glorify the Father which is in heaven. Now, I'm hard put to explain why I had never read those verses that way emotionally, but I never had. And something deep down where I felt about myself turned over in that moment. I realized that all through my life I had been operating on the wrong assumption that I was a nothing that had to be filled by achievement, when in fact I had gifts by the grace of creation and I had worth because of what God had made me. I came to realize that greatness is not something outside that we get inside us by achieving. It is something inside that we get outside by loving and by serving. Isn't this what Jesus meant when he commanded his disciples to bear fruit? Bearing fruit is getting what is inside outside, accepting lovingly the gifts of grace that are there by creation, and then offering them in freedom and love to the world. This was a radically different way of feeling about myself, and then I understood what Paul had meant when he said, "By the grace of God, I am what I am." And it seems like to me that if we ministers are ever going to get free enough to serve in this complexing age, we are going to have to begin where the grace of God begins, namely in the first thing he ever did to us, to make us, and lovingly to accept the gifts that he has placed there and say, "This is where my true light is. I have been given this by the grace of God." And then out of this sense of giftedness, learn to give our gifts in freedom and in hope to the world. Now, I find that when I begin to minister on this term, not having to compete in order to earn, but giving out of what God has given to me, that I am freed of the need to compete, I am freed of the need for others to like me, I can really take the stance of a servant, I can listen to another, and I can give him my gifts. You know, back before this experience happened to me, I was so uneasy as to whether or not people liked me that I really couldn't hear their needs sometimes. In fact, I remember once a seminary student came to my office. I'd never seen him. He sat down, gave me his name, and the first thing he said was, "I don't know why I've come to you, because I really despise hearing you preach. You have this odd speech inflection that just drives me up the wall. I don't know why I'm here." Well, he went on then to explain the problem that he was having. To be perfectly honest with you, I didn't hear a thing he was saying for 5 minutes, because I was so busy putting band-aids on my wounded ego that I couldn't even hear him. He didn't like me, and back then that was everything. I find now that if I can accept the grace of who I am, if I can accept the giftedness of my creation, that now I don't have to please everybody, and I can give my gifts to somebody who may not even like me and be free to do this and not be in bondage to pleasing. This is why I said then at the very beginning that I think the issue debated over Willie Loman's grave is the crucial issue for the minister of today. Here was one son who said he had the right dream. Life is competing. You have to come out the number one man. This is the way to be. The other son said no, he had the wrong dream. And because he followed the wrong dream, he never knew who he was. Most of the ministers I know are still living out of the dream of Willie Loman. Deep down where we feel about ourselves, we are still trying to earn our right to be. We're still bucking to come out number one men. And until the freeing grace of God can say to us, "By the grace of God, you are what you are. Jesus has come to show you that you can accept what you are and begin where God has made you and live out your ministry in freedom." Until this happens, we are in bondage to the people we're called to serve. We are enslaved by our need to be, and therefore we are not free to do. Therefore, it seems like to me that all of us need to ask ourselves, do I accept the first thing that the grace of God ever did to me, namely, to create me? Do I find joy in who I am? Do I sense that greatness is something inside that I get outside by the giving of gifts, not something outside that I try to get inside by achieving? Do I really believe in terms of myself that by the grace of God we're saved? It is not of works of which we can boast. I am by no means totally free of the need to please and to compete. I find myself as late as this morning having twinges of anxiety. Do you like me? Will you accept me? But at least I'm beginning to see life in a different way. I'm seeing grace as a new way of being human and being minister. And therefore, I have to say to you, as I appraise the minister as a man, Jesus Christ has liberated me from the need to compete in order to be, and has opened a way of freedom that is grace indeed. And for that great gift of liberation, I have to say, thank you, Jesus. Many, many thanks.